From Mississippi to New Hampshire, Arizona to North Dakota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, municipalities across the nation are struggling with a dramatic drop in revenue due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Dave Chase from Health Rosetta is here to talk about some cost-saving strategies. A primary election for a Colorado congressional seat saw a local restaurant owner oust a longtime congressman in a major upset. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. The U.S. Supreme Court handed school choice advocates a major victory this past week. Eric Boehm talks with Corey DeAngelis of the Reason Foundation. And Marxists and professional agitators have hijacked legitimate calls for reform. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The severe drop in economic activity due to business shutdowns at the start of the coronavirus pandemic have pushed many local governments to the brink of financial disaster. Dave Chase is founder of Health Rosetta. He has developed strategies for helping municipalities reduce healthcare costs. He joins us now. Dave, welcome to American Radio Journal. Dave, there have been a lot of ramifications as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, the shutdown, the unemployment that resulted. Tell us a bit about how all this is affecting our municipal governments, counties, cities, townships, local government.
Yeah, every public entity goes through their annual budgeting process and they anticipate revenues and they have their expenses. And of course, the revenues, i.e. taxes, have fallen off a cliff. So I don't think there's a community in the country that hasn't been hit, and consequently, there's a major financial deficit that they're having to contend with.
And of course, as with any business, government's also a very large portion of the expenditure is providing health care, health insurance benefits to public employees. Those costs have been going steadily upward for years. How has this pandemic impacted municipalities relative to health care?
Yeah, really, as you mentioned, they're employers like everybody else. And the only tweak I would say on what you said is the prices have gone up. The costs actually haven't gone up. And therein lies the opportunity. And so everybody has seen this annual process. You get less, pay more. And what the wise and awakened purchasers, whether they're a public sector entity or an employer, have found is the best way to slash healthcare costs is improve benefits, which sounds like it's impossible. But when you consider that only 27 cents of every dollar that we ostensibly spend on healthcare goes to the primary value creators, the clinicians, then that gives you a little insight how you can do that.
Where does the rest of those dollars go?
Profiteering and price gouging. It's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's hospitals in our country typically charge at least 2.5 times what other countries charge with some of the worst outcomes. And the pretty amazing 7 of the Fortune 50 companies are, many of them you've never heard of, their primary business or most profitable business is just administering drug programs, not pharmaceutical companies. There's only one pharmaceutical company in the Fortune 50, not even a pure pharmaceutical company, Johnson & Johnson. And that gives you a little idea of how much money is sloshing around. So you see places like from large to small, the state of New Jersey, they've actually gotten wise about their drug procurement, and they've saved $2 billion over the last 3 years. And what was interesting, that came out of basically a partnership between when Governor Christie was in and the Democratic leadership there. So it's actually possible, right? Both sides can get together on these things. So it's pretty amazing how much fat there is in the system right now.
You have, of course, been keeping a close eye on this, having served in local government and in your current role with Health Rosetta. You found a couple of creative ways that local and county governments can deal with healthcare costs. I want to talk to us a little bit about some of those ideas.
there's five straightforward steps, and it really just starts with realizing you can solve the problem. Number two, the way that we have structured these contracts and the way we pay benefits brokers is extremely broken, and we found up to 17 undisclosed revenue streams that the employers had no idea about. Third step, tackle the pharmacy, the drug spending. As I mentioned, tremendous fat there. You can usually drop that portion of it about in half. And then the fourth step is actually a nice value add. In fact, they did this in New Jersey as well, where you add proper primary care. We've really devastated primary care in this country. And the fifth step is essentially addressing the price gouging that too many hospitals are doing. And when you do that, that's where you see whether it's a small school district in rural Colorado drop their spending in half, large school district or actually consortium of school districts in Pennsylvania, they are spending 40% less than their counterparts in Philadelphia. I mean, one that we're just in the middle of right now that's not a realized saving, but we've been called in to help out. This is a city in Florida that is spending about $22 million on healthcare currently. We've seen conservatively, we expect we can drop spending $7.7 million. And each time we've had these estimates, we've overachieved on that. So we're quite confident. So all over the country, rural and urban, you name it, there's ways to do it. It's just once there's the awakening, then you just roll up your sleeves and tackle these things.
Let's talk a little bit more about the city in Florida that you're working with and the way they're dropping it. What sort of strategies are you implementing in order to bring about savings of that sort?
Big part of it is getting rid of the profiteering by the drug supply chain. That's a real low-hanging fruit because actually the members don't notice it at all. You still go to the same pharmacies, but you just get rid of some of the shenanigans. There's actually some states that are passing laws to stop some of those things. Another thing is the primary care. It's interesting that if you look at basically half of ER visits aren't emergencies, 30, 40% of surgeries aren't necessary. So it's really impossible to price gouge, on a ER visit that didn't happen, no surprise bills on an ER visit that didn't happen, no way to price gouge on a surgery that didn't happen, these sort of things. A good, bad example is how we treat lower back pain. We really botched that. That's the number one driver of opioid prescriptions. It's the number one driver of disability. And rather than paying for what works and making it easy to access things like physical therapy, we pay for drugs that don't work, opioids, for something like lower back pain, other than short-term masking of pain, and often surgeries that aren't effective. There's tremendous opportunities in areas like that that we can not only have better outcomes, but actually health outcomes, but save a lot of money in the process.
We have been talking with Dave Chase, who is a founder of Health Rosetta. Dave, tell us a little bit about Health Rosetta. Also, where can folks go if they want to read or learn more about this topic?
Yeah, Health Rosetta is a nonprofit. We have proven nonpartisan fixes to healthcare, and we have seen it all over the place. And you can go see the case studies, even download my books for free at healthrosetta.org. And we welcome anybody to come there. We're happy to point them towards people in their area that are expert at it. And we're just excited about the progress that people are making.
Again, we have been talking with Dave Chase from Health Rosetta, the founder of Health Rosetta. Dave, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have a number of state-by-state primaries taking place. We're going to talk about that. Also, what does the increase in coronavirus positive cases, what impact is that going to have on our economy? We're going to talk about that too. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Let's start out with elections. We'll go to the Rocky Mountain region in Colorado, where there was a big upset this past week. Want to fill us in?
What you had here was an incumbent Republican named Scott Tipton, and he had over $1 million cash on hand in his campaign account, and he went up against a local restaurant owner named Lauren Boebert, and Lauren has a restaurant where they allowed their waiters and waitresses to open carry. And the Second Amendment was a really, really big issue in this district. She sort of became a local activist and confronted Beto O'Rourke during the presidential cycle, gaining a little bit of fame and ultimately deciding as an entrepreneur to jump in to public service and take him on in a Republican primary. Tipton had been endorsed by the president back in December, but the president really wasn't very active in this race. I don't think that Scott Tipton has the strongest relationship with the president, just sort of given his personality. And so Lauren only had a skeleton budget, to be honest. She had about $13,000 cash on hand headed into the final stretch. And she ran a very, very tight budget. She is a mother of four and a restaurant owner, so she says that she's able to find a way to stretch every dollar. And really, she articulated this theme of freedom and government interference against Scott Tipton, who largely has been ineffective for the district. And in the end, she had a clear and convincing victory over Tipton, and she'll be the Republican nominee heading into November. I think what's most interesting about this race is really the money disparity. And, you know, a lot of people think that you need big time bucks to take on anybody that's entrenched in the federal system as an incumbent member. And this is really like David versus Goliath. I think it's probably the biggest congressional upset, certainly since AOC won her race, but on the Republican side since Dave Brett beat Eric Cantor back in 2014. So Lauren still has to win what will probably be a pretty close race in November. This is Republican-leaning district, but as we look at Colorado in the presidential cycle, voter enthusiasm is always really, really important, and the dynamics of this race will basically be a state representative that's represented the ski resort areas of Colorado against a local mom who is a restaurant owner that allows for open carry and freedom.
It's going to be a very interesting race to keep an eye on, one of a number we're going to spotlight around the country as we move forward. Let's switch gears just a little bit here, Scott. Economic data continues to come out. We've had an increase in positive cases in coronavirus, significant in some states. What sort of impact is that having on the economy? Are we in a recovery process, and will we be able to continue on that path?
The data that came out this week was obviously positive. We had expectations smashed for the month of June with 4.8 million jobs added to the economy and the unemployment rate dropping down to 11.1%. But, you know, obviously we've still got roughly 40 million people that are out of work. To really erase as much of that economic harm as possible. And meanwhile, we are seeing the number of cases on a daily rate in the 50,000 range nationally. So there are some hot spots that are appearing throughout the country in a number of states. Some of that could be the impact of the reopening. Some of it could be the impact of the nationwide protests we've seen in a lot of urban communities over the past month. But the bottom line is there are a large number of younger people that are getting coronavirus. Maybe some of them are just the point of, hey, I gave this 3-4 months of staying home, and now I'm ready to go out and enjoy my summer. But ultimately, I think that the purpose of the lockdown, the stay-at-home orders, was to bend the curve and to slow the rate of growth. We did that. And nobody said that there was going to be a cure by this summer. They're still working hard on a vaccination. But the bottom line is that we need to have herd immunity to get the economy fully back open and to resume normalcy for, you know, really the way things looked about 7 or 8 months ago. More people are definitely going to be getting sick, but I think what's important to keep an eye on is whether or not our healthcare system is overwhelmed in terms of the number of hospital beds and ventilators that are available. And right now, it does appear that a lot of the people that are getting positive tests for coronavirus are asymptomatic and younger and healthy and not really facing the life or death situation, being attached to a ventilator in the hospital. So there is some, obviously, perspective to take in here and think about how things are going to go to the summer. Certainly, you still want to avoid being around older and people that are prone to getting sick, people with a pre-existing condition. We don't want to really jeopardize other people's health. But I think that a lot of younger and healthy people are ready to sort of tackle the future and get on.
We saw the third quarter, the equity market, Scott, had one of their best quarters in decades. So are we actually seeing that V-shaped recovery that we talked about several months ago?
Well, honestly, I think it's probably a little bit too early to say. I think that we'll know in about 2 months if this recovery is going to be strong enough to put us in a situation where we're not battling a hurt economy for a long time. The economic data that comes out following sort of the end of the fiscal year around October 1st, heading into the election, is going to be quite alarming, I think, for everybody. But the bottom line is, we know what the economic situation is. Nobody should be surprised by it. So I think the markets are reacting in a favorable fashion.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson, who joins us every week from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If people want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
The U.S. Supreme Court handed parents seeking more educational opportunities for their children a major victory this past week. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Corey DeAngelis of the Reason Foundation.
The U.S. Supreme Court delivered a major victory this week for both school choice and religious liberty. The case is Espinoza v. Montana Department of Revenue. It's centered on a scholarship program created back in 2015 by the Montana legislature to provide parental and student choice in education. But the Montana Supreme Court in 2018 killed that scholarship program. It decided that the program violated a provision in the Montana Constitution that bars the use of public funds for religious purposes. Basically, the court said that it ran afoul of the old separation of church and state rules. But the U.S. Supreme Court overruled the Montana Supreme Court this week and ruled that the scholarship program does not violate the separation of church and state at all. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court said that it was unconstitutional to dismantle the program. Joining us now to talk about this important case and its ramifications is Corey DeAngelis. He's the director of school choice for the Reason Foundation. Corey, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Now, full disclosure here, Corey, the Reason Foundation, first of all, you're a colleague of mine at the Reason Foundation, and the Reason Foundation filed an amicus brief in support of Kendra Espinoza, who was the defendant in this case. So you were involved in this the whole time. The big takeaway here is that the Supreme Court says that states cannot exclude religious schools from this type of school choice program, right?
Yeah, Montana pretty much nixed its program at the state Supreme Court level in 2018 after the program had been enacted for 3 years already, because they were arguing that this was a separation of church and state issue, which it actually is not, and I'll get into why that is in a second. But this is a huge case for school choice proponents because the U.S. Supreme Court took up this case and ruled that excluding religious schools from private school choice programs, if you're going to have a private school choice program in your state, is unconstitutional because it's a clear violation of the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and it clearly discriminates against religious groups, a government program that was nixed because they were saying that the funding could be used for religious schools, and that's why they tried to get rid of the program.
There are sort of like two different competing First Amendment issues here. On one hand, the Montana Supreme Court originally struck down the scholarship program because they said it violated the separation of church and state. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court says that striking it down was unconstitutional because Americans have a First Amendment right to exercise the religion of their choosing. So I guess to just sort of take the opposite side of it for a second, why is this not a separation of church and state issue?
The other side says that there's an establishment clause issue, which is people refer to it as a separation of church and state issue. But those same people wouldn't say that Pell Grants at the higher education level were unconstitutional or a violation of the Establishment Clause. And the same people wouldn't say that Social Security dollars being used for private school, religious school tuition were unconstitutional. And the reason for that is made pretty clear in a 2002 Supreme Court case at the United States Supreme Court, Zelman versus Simmons-Harris. This was about a publicly funded private school voucher program in Ohio. And they ruled that because the money went from the government funds to the individual family, and the families were able to choose to send their kids to government-run schools or private religious or non-religious private schools, because there's that separation and the family's making that decision and the family is the main beneficiary of the program, there's no separation of church and state issue, and voucher programs, even if they're publicly funded, do not violate the Establishment Clause.
So that's the intermediate step that really matters there, the having the family decide where the money goes, not the state. That's the key step.
Yep, and just think about other programs that we have that are taxpayer funded. Pell grants go to individuals, go to a public university, or they can go to a private university, and they can even go to a religious private university such as Notre Dame. Same thing with the GI Bill for veterans. They can use these vouchers essentially at the higher education level for religious universities as well. Social Security funding is obviously taxpayer dollars. It's public dollars. And you can use those to send your kid to a religious private school if you want. And that doesn't violate the Establishment Clause because the main beneficiary is the individual who gets the money and can decide where to spend those dollars at a religious or non-religious establishment. And then also, I also want to say the Montana program was privately funded. It was a tax credit scholarship. These are all private donations. And as the U.S. Supreme Court stated in ACSTO versus Wynn in 2011, private dollars remain private until they enter the tax collector's hands. And since these are donations, they are private dollars. There's obviously no separation of church and state issue because these are the Montana program doesn't even use public dollars. These are private dollars.
Yeah, right. When the state isn't really involved at all, when you look at it that way, the state has no role to play. We are talking with Corey DeAngelis. He is the director of school choice for the Reason Foundation. Corey, just about a minute left here. So quickly, tell me why this ruling matters for people who aren't living in Montana. This will have ramifications in other states too.
The quick implication of this case is that the Montana families who were using that program before are now able to use that program again to use the tax credit scholarships to attend religious or non-religious private schools of their choosing, because the only thing that was stepping in their way was that state-level Supreme Court decision that blocked them. Then also states like Maine and New Hampshire that have programs that are currently discriminating against religious people, they'll need to change that. And then 37 state constitutions in the United States have things called Blaine Amendments, which are rooted in anti-Catholic bigotry and anti-immigrant bigotry that have been around in the United States since the late 19th century. And so this case strikes a mortal blow to these discriminatory Blaine Amendments in those states as well, so which could make it easier to enact private school choice programs in those states as well.
So hopefully that means we will see even more school choice programs like this one established in other places. Thanks a lot, Corey.
Thank you so much.
And again, that is Corey DeAngelis. He is the director of school choice for the Reason Foundation. You can check out his work at reason.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Find our work at reason.com, including coverage of this and a number of other really important Supreme Court decisions that came down in the past few weeks. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Legitimate efforts at fostering racial equality are being hijacked by radical elements seeking to use protests for their own purposes. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
On March 25, 1931, two white women, Victoria Price and Ruby Bates, claimed that they had been raped by nine black teenagers along the railroad from Chattanooga to Memphis. A citizen posse took the law into its hands and arrested the boys, transporting them to jail cells in nearby Scottsboro. As news spread, enraged whites gathered outside the jail, ready to form a lynch mob. Local authorities promised quick justice to the seething local vigilantes. 5 days later, an all-white jury indicted the nine black boys. The case of the Scottsboro Boys, as it came to be known, was nationally known as a serious miscarriage of justice. The boys literally fought for their lives against a rigged system. Decent Americans were outraged. Something needed to be done. People with cooler heads needed to calm the situation. Unfortunately, the Scottsboro case became further inflamed. It attracted some of the worst elements of the Marxist left. American communists from Communist Party USA saw a delicious opportunity to sweep in. They attempted to hijack the case and the cause. Really, this was no surprise. Communists had long been and still are adept at agitating, instigating, and organizing. They're trained in the art. As skilled propagandists, they're really good at raising lots of chaos without a lot of members, at fomenting discord and getting people into the streets. So how does Scottsboro relate to today? Well, think of the George Floyd tragedy. In both cases, the Scottsboro boys and George Floyd, you had genuine racial injustices that deserved condemnation and protest. Only a cretin couldn't feel for George Floyd or the Scottsboro boys and their suffering. And unfortunately, both have become episodes for exploitation by revolutionary ideologues with wider purposes and agendas. Patrice Cullors, the founder of Black Lives Matter, along with her co-founder Alicia Garza, says this: "We actually do have an ideological frame. We are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists. We are super versed on ideological theories." Yes, that's Patrice Cullors and Alicia Garza, co-founders of Black Lives Matter. They are self-acknowledged trained Marxists. That's their ideological framework. And that being so, they know how to tap an issue, the more legitimate the better, to rage against the existing social and political order. Marx and Engels, at the close of the Communist Manifesto, wrote this, quote, "Communists everywhere support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order of things," unquote. Unfortunately, that's what seems to be going on right now. Certain radicals are cynically exploiting a genuine injustice like the George Floyd killing for a larger ideological purpose. Oftentimes, that purpose is simply to tear down, to take down, to stir chaos and disorder. For example, calls for defunding the police? That's merely going to generate more chaos and disorder. Sure, obviously the vast majority attending rallies and protests of the George Floyd killing aren't Marxists, of course. But for certain ringleaders, they will support a revolutionary movement that goes against the existing social and political order of things. And for Black Lives Matter, that's a wide-ranging panoply of revolutionary change that goes way beyond George Floyd or black issues. Black Lives Matter states at its website that it seeks to, quote, "disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure," unquote. In its "What We Believe" statement at its website, it's remarkably cultural and sexual, using words like trans 4 times, queer once, heteronormative, comrades twice. What does that have to do with George Floyd? The answer, nothing. And what does that mean for you, or maybe for your kid thinking about signing on the dotted line? Well, it means this: be careful and vigilant in finding out groups to express your outrage and the desire for intelligent reform. Don't rally to the wrong guys. Know who they are. Write a check to the NAACP if you want. Be smart. If you want to protest the George Floyd killing, there are 1,000 ways to do so without supporting Marxist revolutionaries. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBBC-FM, WKLV-AM and FM in Blackstone, Virginia, along with KXBR-FM in International Falls, Minnesota. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.